This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 2 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Before we get going with the show, I wanted to remind everyone that you can subscribe for the Late Round Podcast by searching not for the Late Round Podcast on iTunes, but the Number Fire Podcast Network. All shows will be under that bucket, so make sure that you're subscribed there or on Stitcher on SoundCloud so that you don't miss a show. I have to tell you guys, I have a great job. I get to work from home. I get to write about football and fantasy football. I get to spew hot takes on Twitter to just see how people react. Hopefully I don't spew that many hot takes. It's great though. I get to wear gym shorts every day. I have like 30 pairs of gym shorts. I have like two drawers full of gym shorts because that's all I wear. And I live in Charlotte, so it's acceptable to wear gym shorts year round for the most part. I don't get that many looks. I get some looks when it's 30 degrees outside, but even still, it's not terrible to wear gym shorts year round in Charlotte. So when I go to like a bar or if I'm in a social setting, you know, my wife and I go out and we're hanging out with some friends and we meet some people. Because I have this job, I oftentimes get interesting questions or get people that are intrigued by what I do. And it's not because I think that what I do is so spectacular and life-changing. In fact, I've had many existential crises in my life thinking, man, I'm writing about a sport, a game about a game, right? Fantasy football is a game within a game. Fantasy football is the inception of sports. I've had many existential crises because of this. So don't think that I think that my job is very, very special because I think that it's the opposite of special. But people are interested. They say, oh, what do you do? And I say, oh, I'm the editor-in-chief of a sports analytics company. And they say, oh, what does that entail? And I say, oh, you know, I manage a lot of brilliant writers that we have, and I write about football, more specifically fantasy. You write about fantasy football? That's what usually the conversation goes that way. I say, yeah, I write about fantasy football. I wrote an ebook, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and I just kind of explain, you know, what I do. And people are intrigued. It's just how it is, because usually when you talk to someone, they say, hey, I'm an accountant. There's nothing wrong with accountants. We need accountants. Or, hey, I'm in finance. Nothing wrong with that. I just have a different kind of job that people don't hear about every day. They're just shocked that I'm making a living doing something so ridiculously stupid. Because fantasy football, in the end, is stupid. Fantasy football is dumb. I love fantasy football, but I am not normal. It's stupid. Fantasy football is stupid. We all love it because it's just this entertaining piece of our lives, but no one's saving children through playing fantasy football or analyzing fantasy football. I've wasted way too much time. If I really wanted to make an impact on the world, I shouldn't have been a fantasy football analyst. But when I talk to these new acquaintances, I try to gauge how much they know about football. When I first start saying, yeah, I'm the editor-in-chief of a sports analytics site and I do this and that, I try to gauge what they know about football because I don't want to talk to them and sound like some condescending prick. Because, I mean, let's be honest. I know more about football than the average Joe. A lot more. And that's because it's my job. Just like someone, again, working as an accountant knows more about taxes than I do because that's their job. I should know more about football than someone that I randomly meet at a bar or someone that I meet at my wife's work Christmas party. I should know more. So when I talk to these people, you know, I'll say, I hate whenever I meet someone new. I don't want to dominate the conversation. I try to ask as many questions as I can to just help the flow of the conversation. I don't want to be the guy who dominates the conversation. That's not fun. But when I talk to them, I don't want them to feel uncomfortable or that I'm just trying to prove them wrong with like a football topic. So if for instance, they are interested in football, you know, sometimes I'll say, hey, yeah, I do fantasy football stuff. And they're like, oh, fix my team. And they'll pull out their phone. They'll hand it to me. I'll look at their lineup and I'm like, dude, this is fine. Your lineup's great. It's like they need some sort of approval from me, even though they've never read a single thing that I've ever written. But I don't want to talk to someone who marginally knows football and I don't know, destroy them in a discussion? You know, I'm not the most opinionated person in the world. I think that when it comes to sports, though, and football in particular, I become more opinionated because it's something that I'm passionate about and something that I study all the time. So, you know, I'll meet a wide variety of people. Some people don't know sports, some people moderately know sports, and the hardcore people who, yeah, they can carry a conversation and I can get a little heated and it'll be fun. You know, that's what we do, right? We just talk about sports and it's great because they know a lot about sports and that's awesome. Sometimes, though, you just can't even tell if the person you're talking to knows about football or not. But regardless, if the person is at all interested in talking football, there are two questions that I ask them as sort of a litmus test to sort of gauge where this conversation is going. The first one, is Tony Romo a good quarterback? And the second one, is or was Jeff Fisher a good head coach? Generally, the people answering yes to the Jeff Fisher question, generally those people are 65-year-old dads who always wear tennis shoes with grass stains on them. Seriously, guys, dads with 20-something-year-old children love Jeff Fisher. They love Jeff Fisher. If someone ends up saying that Tony Romo is bad, this is the big one. And it just so happens that Tony Romo announced that he was retiring before this segment, and I was planning on talking about Tony Romo, but I'll still go with it. If someone says that Tony Romo is bad, I have to step away a bit. I have to realize that this person falls into the casual fan but tries really hard to pretend they're a hardcore fan bucket and category. And that's a scary person to talk to. To me, there's like the fandom spectrum. You have very, very casual fans who they don't really care if their team wins or not. It's not that big of a deal. And then the next layer up, the next step up, are people who are fairly casual, but for whatever reason, they get so bent out of shape when their team loses. Even though they don't follow the team that closely, they get so bent out of shape when that team loses. And then there's the hardcore fan, which are split up into two pieces where some hardcore fans get very upset whenever their team loses. I can understand that. By the way, I mean upset as in like your life, you have a life-altering moment when your team loses a game. The rest of your week is crushed. This is, look, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, born and raised, and that when the Steelers lost a game, the city of Pittsburgh shut down. The city of Pittsburgh just cried and wept until the next Sunday. But you have these people who are hardcore fans, they get really upset, and then you have other people, I think I fall in this bucket for the most part, where I'm going to be upset for about a half hour to an hour after a game, but I get over it quickly. I think just doing this job now has made me be a little bit more objective, and I don't get as angry about losses. I get more excited about wins. You know, I try to be positive. But the people who are casual fans and for whatever reason get super, super upset when their team loses, those are the people who think Tony Romo is bad. And look, I think that any rational, good, smart football fan would at least tell you that Tony Romo is good. I'm not even talking about Hall of Fame good either. I'm just talking about an above average, strong signal caller, a good quarterback. But the fact is that narratives spread. And that's why I asked that question, because narratives spread. People think the things that they do because they're listening to what larger media outlets and talking heads are saying. And some of those people are generally drawing conclusions in a biased manner because they want these narratives to exist. So when I ask the question, is Tony Romo good? What I'm doing is I'm gauging to see if these people are buying into these crazy narratives without actually digging in and looking themselves. Because the hardcore fans who I'm going to be able to have an hour-long conversation with about Andre Holmes, they're going to know that Tony Romo's good because they look at the numbers or they watch him. But I mean, look at Tony Romo, for example. Why does he choke? Because millions of people saw him choke in 2007 against the Seahawks in a wild card game. That's why people think that he chokes. Then there was just bias towards that anytime he screwed up in the fourth quarter, despite the fact that every quarterback throws picks in the fourth quarter or late in games. Talking heads just love that stuff, man. No matter how inaccurate it is, they love spreading these narratives. They love it. That's what boosts ratings. So there's this sort of like narrative bias in that high-level football analysis. But let's not pretend that there's not bias in other football analysis too. Let's not fool ourselves. Generally, we can break football analysis up into two pieces. We have data and we have film. If you've been on football Twitter for a while, you may be aware of the debates. They happen. people get all bent out of shape about, oh, film is better. Oh, data is better. It's happened. It's going to happen forever. But let's look first at the data side and talk about what I mean by these biases and these narratives that are created. Now, I come from the analytical side of things, but I also know that data is not perfect. Or should I say, the way we interpret data and the choices we make with data is far from perfect. I always tell people that the reason you should want to look at analytics in football is not to always have concrete answers, because there are no concrete answers. The reason you look at data in football and in sports is to increase probability, is to be better. Some numbers are better than others, though. For instance, our net expected points metric is going to be better, more predictive, more descriptive, all of the above, than a counting statistic like yards. And that's where we can get into trouble with numbers. Someone can cite touchdown to interception ratio and say this quarterback was good, and that creates a general narrative about that quarterback. Or let's look at Blake Bortles two seasons ago. He throws 35 touchdowns. Everyone thinks that he's a good quarterback as a result. But any model, any analytical model shows that Blake Bortles was still a below average quarterback in 2015. You can most definitely create narratives and biases with numbers. It happens all the time. I even fall into the trap because it's really, really easy to. And to be truthful, numbers don't always capture some of the nuances happening on the football field. It's not as simple as baseball, where everything is this one-to-one relationship, where sabermetrics are so amazing because it's very easy to capture what's going on a baseball field. You get a pitcher versus a batter matchup. Football is complex as hell. There's 11 matchups on the field on each play. It's very, very hard to capture with one single metric. And even a group of metrics. It's tough. You have to know what you're looking for in these numbers. And since numbers are widely available to people to look at, you can go to profootballreference.com and look at adjusted net yards per attempt. But people will look at total yardage, cumulative yardage, and metrics that really don't capture how good or bad a particular player was. And that helps drive narratives. And then on the flip side of things, we have film. Film naturally brings subjectivity, especially if people aren't trained to actually know what they're looking for when they're watching film. And on top of this subjectivity, nothing is more frustrating for me than seeing these analysts throw out these random grades of players without really showing what the system for grading is or what it means or giving context to what those grades are. They'll say things like, this guy gets an 8 out of 10 for his pass catching skills. What does that mean? What does an 8 out of 10 even mean? These biases are everywhere. Numbers don't always capture what happens with film. Film can't possibly give you a significant, consistent sample size. And talking heads are out there telling us that Tony Romo isn't clutch and that Jeff Fisher has more than 6 winning seasons out of the 22 that he coached. They're trying to tell you that Jeff Fisher is good or that Tony Romo is bad. But what we need to do is to keep pushing the limits with football. This is why I love football analysis, by the way, is because we're not there yet. We're not at the level of baseball. I know that there's more baseball metrics that come out every single year, and the kind of stuff that they're tracking in baseball is amazingly interesting. I love baseball. But football is so far behind that I like to be in it now as it starts to evolve more and more. And we need to keep pushing those limits to close these gaps and to have more concrete info. And one of those ways that we can do that is through player charting, which is having a methodical way of watching film that then allows for actual data points to be created as a result. In some ways, it's sort of like marrying film watching with numbers. One person who's been doing this for a few years now with the wide receiver position, a position that most of us care a heck of a lot about because of fantasy football, is NFL.com's Matt Harmon. Harmon's reception perception has completely changed the way that a lot of people look at the position. When he says something about a wide receiver, people notice. I actually sat down with Matt and talked to him about all of this, why he thinks reception perception is a necessary tool, how he's charting these wide receivers, how he ignores the biases and narratives that I talked through earlier, and more. A ton more. We even talked about small dogs. Have a listen. All right, Matt, I gotta ask you, because you are on Team Small Dog, as I am on Team Small Dog, can you tell everyone why small dogs are the best dogs?
Well, for one, you know, I live in Los Angeles, for those who don't know, so I'm And obviously I'm not in the 1% of people that can actually afford to live in a home out here. So I live in an apartment. I've lived in apartments since I've graduated from college. And, you know, it's much easier to have a smaller dog in this sort of situation. Like my younger sister, strange enough as it is, like she has a giant golden doodle. And it's like, I couldn't imagine that horse running through my apartment here.
Right. So yeah.
Much more convenient. Also, you know, for traveling, anything, just much more convenient. Also, like, you know, he sleeps in the same bed as me at night. And like, it's, you know, not like there's another human in there. It's just a very easy, convenient, small dog. And look, there's no rules to this. You know, I always thought I would have a big dog, but then by happenstance, Charlie came into my existence and here we are.
Yeah, no, I totally feel you, man. And I think the important thing too is that a lot of people, there's a perception out there that I think that we need to help break with the audience that we have. Not that it's a massive audience, but we need to do our best to show that small dogs are dogs too. They have personality too. It's important.
Yeah, all dogs matter, okay? And especially small dogs. Listen, I'm sure we look like a weird pair walking down the street because I'm about 209, 6'3", like he's like all of, you know, 15 pounds on a fat day. So we look a little bizarre walking down the street together, but that only adds to the charm, in my opinion.
I totally agree. All right, Matt. So today I want to talk a little bit about player charting and more specifically what you do with reception perception. You've been doing this, 3 years now that you've been doing reception perception?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't you, before we dig into it specifically, just kind of let the listeners know what reception perception is all about, how it started, why you started it, and all of that.
Sure thing. Well, I mean, we'll get into, you know, the advantages of why I wanted to do it and what I think is important about it. But, you know, also, and I talk about this on the Backyard Banter podcast, which you were, I think, the third guest I ever had on the show. And, you know, that is all about obviously trying to break into the writing industry. And I think the biggest piece of advice to anybody out there is like find a unique piece of content, find a niche that you can operate in. And I wanted mine to be about wide receivers. So that's the kind of selfish reason why I started. It was I needed something to stand out. Now, in terms of what reception perception is, it's a unique in-depth charting methodology to evaluate the wide receiver position. You know, we hear all the time anecdotes thrown out about the position, especially during the games, because you know, the broadcaster can see them up in the booth, but the viewing audience at home cannot. They go off the screen most of the time when they're running their routes. So you hear a lot of things, you know, this guy never gets open or this guy's a great route runner. You know, traditional scouting reports are, you know, I gave him a 7 out of 10 of route running. Like, I don't really know what that means. And I don't, you know, I don't just necessarily just want to take somebody's word for it. And I don't think anybody should. So what I'm essentially doing is I'm going in and charting on a route by route basis for 8 games for an NFL player, 6 games for a college player, because that's half the season. And it's also where I've seen the data kind of normalize for a full season scope. I chart every single route that they run over those games, what route they run, how often they get open on each branch of the route tree, what type of coverages are they most successful. Also, you know, some ancillary metrics like contested catch rate or the like breaking tackles after the catch. So really you get a full scope of what a wide receiver does well. But most specifically, it's kind of about quantifying the qualitative art of how good of a route runner is this player on film. So that's kind of the big thesis of it.
So what do you think then, you know, as a result of this, what do you think is really the worthwhile advantage of doing this as opposed to, you know, there's a lot of people that will do in-depth analytical studies and there's a lot of people who are good at watching film. Why is it that something like reception perception, why do you think that it's special and unique and needed and necessary too?
Well, I think, it's just showing your work and being forthright with what you see is important to me, because why should anybody trust some random guy on this? You know, I guess it's a lot of it is showing your work, but I think how a player plays and what they do on film is always going to matter. Like, it's bizarre to me to hear sometimes people say like, oh yeah, watching film doesn't matter at all, because it's like, it seems like silly. Like how they play and observing that is important, but observational science is inherently just very fragile, and we're very fragile in terms of how we are able to interpret and then therefore convey our observations. So this is essentially just, you're kind of getting to look at my rubric, what I've charted, and it's presented in a way that helps you, again, kind of compare player to player much better than just the typical, like, AJ Green is a good route runner, whereas Brandon Marshall is a bad route runner. And I'm not saying that that's true, but that's just an example. Like, this shows you, well, AJ Green is this successful against this type of coverage and less successful against this type of coverage. And he's also better on these intermediate routes. Whereas, and then you can compare that to other players. So I think it not only does it keep me honest, but it also keeps the analysis honest.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, let's picture a scenario where someone says, hey, I want you to go do a reception perception of Corey Coleman. So you heard, for instance, let's just say that Corey Coleman is not very good at running nine routes. He doesn't have speed to separate. This is completely just random. I'm not saying that Corey Coleman is any of this. It's just the first wide receiver that popped in my head. But you hear all these narratives about Corey Coleman. So if you go and you sit down and you're about to watch Corey Coleman and chart his routes, what specific things are you looking for? And are you sort of trying to confirm or deny those narratives as you go in to watch that player?
Well, I think the great part about a piece of analysis like this with a very specific, you know, I hate to use the word grading, but very specific like rubric and charting system, that kind of eliminates those narratives or might portray them as false when it's just something that's widely accepted. And I think that the worst thing that we see all the time is like, yeah, sometimes you'll hear one analyst say this thing about a player. And then a lot of people will go into watching film, again, if they're just straight watching film, you know, and just taking notes off it or whatever, which I think is a highly inefficient method of doing observational science. You'll just see them find pieces of evidence to confirm that or whatever their agenda might be. You know, Mike Williams is a prospect that I think is a good example of this year where, you know, on his draft breakdown clips or whatever, you see him making a lot of contested catches. And then I think you then your brain just went naturally going to extrapolate like, well, yeah, he's making all those contested catches because he doesn't separate really well. And, you know, he's not the best separator in this class in reception perception, but he's certainly like at a good enough level where he's an Alshon Jeffrey type of player or something like that. So yeah, a lot of it is just being, again, you can't, if you have a very specific like charting system, it's hard to then like get influenced by narratives or whatever. If you're just logging what you see and then looking at the results over a, you know, relatively wide football speaking sample size.
Right. But then at the same time, I would assume that when you go to write your column about a particular article from a reception perception study that you did, you're going to feed those narratives in a way, right? Like you will do an objective study on this player and say, let's say, you know, John Ross can create massive separation down the field, right? And you're going to confirm that, like, let's say that the numbers confirm that. When you write the column, you're going to, I would assume, kind of play into the narrative at least a little bit to either confirm or deny, just because that's how content works, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of that problem that I talked about. Like, people will, well, yeah, but Matt Harmon said this.
Right.
And I've always tried, and this is not something that is easy to do because, again, like you said, it's just how content works. I have always claimed and just said that reception perception is just a piece of the puzzle. You know, it's one analyst. It's a better way of conveying my opinion and my observations of what I see than I think just telling you, you know, like these are my notes on this player or whatever. But again, it's just one piece of the puzzle. And I would caution any of your listeners or anybody out there against following an analyst that says that their analysis is the only piece of the puzzle, or this is the only way to analyze players. Like, we're all approaching that, you know, our buddy Sigmund Bloom talks about it like we're essentially an academic department. We're all trying to find the truth in the same thing, but we come at it at very different directions. Mm. And that's a good thing. You know, if my analysis can supplement somebody else's different style, different techniques of analysis, that's a good thing. I don't have all the answers, but yeah, you're right. That obviously that's going to end up happening based on my work as well.
Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense. If something that you're working on confirms something or denies something, I mean, look, that's what creates great content. I mean, one of the highest read articles that we've ever had at NumberFire was about the Tony Romo narrative and why it was just complete trash, how everyone thinks one way, but numbers and everything else says another thing. Then obviously you're going to want to right about that, not just because you know, you're trying to be subjective with your study, or you're trying to change the way your study went. It's just because you want to drive traffic and you want to be interesting in some way. So I totally understand that. I think that you make a really good point, though, with groupthink and the way that folks kind of approach this, where some draft analysts, you included, with reception perception, you know, you come out and you say, hey, Allen Robinson is the GOAT. Then all of a sudden everyone's going to say, hey, Matt Harmon loves Allen Robinson, so therefore I love Allen Robinson. That's probably putting a lot of pressure on you too, which is a little unfortunate, but that's all part of the game.
It pays the bills, man. So
right. Exactly. So I think one thing that I'm really interested to hear your take on, because you're looking at wide receivers in a way that not a lot of people get to look at wide receivers. And if you look at the fantasy industry specifically, I think a big part of what we do, since it's all so numbers driven, is folks love measurables. But even though these measurables don't translate to fantasy success directly, you know, I'm basically just curious as to where you stand on the combine, on measurables, how much weight you put into a guy's 40, you know, a guy's vertical, all that kind of stuff, given what you do with reception perception.
Yeah, I mean, I find all of that incredibly fascinating. I like to consume that content. I mean, the combine is so fun to follow because it can be a part of that confirmation or dismissal of narratives too. You know, so a guy like Chris Godwin, who I really like, goes out and puts out a big performance. It draws some attention to them, and, you know, makes you kind of, I love when film analysts say, like, well, this needs to make me go back to the film or whatever, because that inherently admits the problem with watching film, which is that it's hard to contextualize it. It's hard to remove your brain biases out of it. But the combine is hard, verifiable data. Does it always mean something? No, I don't think so. And in fact, like, you know, the great part about having now 3 years of NFL data and 2 years of college data is that I'm starting to get a decent enough group of players that I can go and kind of test different metrics against my findings. Like the only one that I've published so far, is how, like, reception perception, its main metrics in terms of success rate versus man zone press coverage and contested catch conversion rate, like how that correlates with prospect age during their final year. And I put this out on thebackyardbanter.com, which is my blog. And like, the scatter plots are all just pretty random. So that is a good thing for me to see, because I had heard rumblings out there of like, well, is our film analyst biased towards, you know, young, older players because they're, you know, older than the cornerbacks across them, this, that, and the other, they're more experienced. And through my findings, it's like, well, at least for my methods, no, I don't find there to be like an age bias. It's like, there are a lot of young players that score really well. There are a lot of young players that score poorly, and vice versa. So, I think that's something that's cool now, is like, and I'm also looking at that in terms of height and weight for contested catch conversion rate. And a lot of it is, you know, just, again, very a little bit random. And I think that's a fun part too, is testing, like, what do, because that's what I think film is all about, is studying it to kind of observe outliers, observe things that are not necessarily, like, just, again, those general assumptions, like, oh, this is a bigger guy, he must be better at winning contested catches. Like, you know, that's not always necessarily true. Like, some guys like Odell Beckham and Antonio Brown, who are obviously, you know, a couple of goats, but like, they have really high conversion rates despite their size. So I think all those measurables are incredibly important. I, again, like to consume them all, but of course I'm always going to try to test that again against my work.
Yeah. What's interesting about what you said is that you can look at what you've found as a successful wide receiver through reception perception. Whereas I think the biggest problem that I've run into with prospect evaluation, what I've seen other analysts and other articles run into as well, is that when you're trying to compare how important these measurables are, you have to have some sort of some sort of set of a group of wide receivers that you're comparing it to. And so if you're looking at, let's say, quote unquote, successful wide receivers, well, what defines successful? And I think that with reception perception, you at least have a pretty strong idea as to what is successful, because you're looking at these guys so specifically and particularly. Whereas, you know, for me, let's say that I'm looking at guys who rank well within our net expected points metric or something. that might not capture the same types of things. So it at least gives you something to compare and contrast. The other thing too, though, that I'm really curious about. So you mentioned Chris Godwin. So when his measurables came out and you did your reception perception, did his measurables at all strengthen or weaken? I guess strengthen just because he had a good combine, but did that strengthen the way that you felt about him?
Yeah, well, one thing, if I could just kind of double back on what you were saying right before you asked that question, is that, like, yeah, I try to think that, or I at least believe that, like, reception perception is a really great way of quantifying wide receiver performance, because the job of a wide receiver is to run your routes, get open, and then when the target comes your way, you know, if it's a difficult contested catch, you make that catch. But most of their job, that, like, what they're doing over the large field of a game is running routes and creating separation, but that's not always shown up in raw production or fantasy points or whatever. So those things, those have other variables in there in terms of what the quarterback does, what the offensive line play does. This is the, it's hard to isolate player performance through one metric, but I think this is, you know, charting film is really the best way to do that. So yeah, I agree with you in that, like, and you know, I've also, the one thing I never claim is that, like, yeah, if a player is good in reception perception, that means he's going to be great in fantasy. That's not always necessarily the case, because obviously we know that opportunity and situations and matchups go into all that as well. So I just wanted to make that point. But on Chris Godwin in particular, and, you know, the general weight of the combine, yeah, I think that's hugely important, because, again, I think it also does kind of, you know, I don't want to, like, it lends a little credence to, like, what you see when when you see a player like Malcolm Mitchell was kind of the same sort of situation last year. He didn't completely blow up the combine, but he had a really good 40 time, really good broad jump, really big hands. And, like, him going out having a good combine performance also kind of, to me, like, lended a little credence to his really outstanding reception perception, because both Godwin and Mitchell, like, when I was charting them, and that is, like, kind of towards the end of the college football season and before before the Super Bowl is really when I get most of this charting work done with prospects. Like, those are two guys, both of them were, that were kind of had, like, round four-ish grades or whatever.
Yeah, no one was talking about them. Yeah.
Major draft sites, but, you know, I put out the column for Malcolm Mitchell after the combine last year with him, and, you know, said he was, like, a top 10 receiver to me, no question. And Chris Godwin, like, the day before the combine, I put out a piece on him saying, you know, he's the most underrated prospect in the class. He's probably not so underrated anymore, but again, that's just, like, showing you those things, you know, for whatever reason, other analysts might've missed it when watching him, but those things, again, when you see them at the combine, kind of lend a little bit of credence to that. So I think it's very important. But again, you know, and how they test athletically is different than how they perform on the field. But I think, again, it's taking all of those different factors and finding a way to weight them. But there's no uniform way of doing that, too. I don't think, I always find it disingenuous when people are like, well, the Senior Bowl is 10% of my evaluation, because it's different. I mean, these are all, we're all studying human subjects. And right. I'm ranting a little bit here, but, like,
that's great.
You know, we're all studying human subjects, and, like, I think analysis that doesn't kind of take that into effect is also incredibly foolish too, but because 10% for one other player might not, it should not necessarily be 10% for another player. So a lot of different answers to the question there, but I think at some point I might've hit it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you also mentioned, which is a key point that we probably should have brought up even before we started talking about that, is the fact that what you're doing with reception perception is not production based. It's not, you're not sitting here and looking at and analyzing these numbers and thinking, you know, and seeing throws that only go their way in particular times of the game, or throws that they catch only. You're seeing a greater picture for these wide receivers, which leads me to asking you, through doing reception perception, are there metrics or statistics that you found that sort of match what your charting generally says, or how things go with your charting? And then on the opposite side of the spectrum, while you're charting these wide receivers, do you often find that some statistics that probably some statistics that a lot of people use a lot are kind of irrelevant?
In terms of what I found that matches my charting, I don't really have a hard answer for that. Like I said, that this is something I'm exploring, especially this off season, probably much closer to before the season starts, just time wise. I'd like to test reception perception results and see what kind of relationship they do show to different production metrics. So, I mean, in general, I do just tend to think, like, a lot of it's very rare, I would say, that like a player that I like in reception perception, you know, tends to like suck or whatever. Right. I haven't seen too much of that. Yeah, they might not be the best fantasy players or whatever based on the other factors we're talking about. But, you know, I haven't I'm going to kind of give a little bit of a non-answer to that. But in terms of what I think don't like do not matter or that I don't put a lot of weight in, like get all of like the per target or per whatever, like get those out of my life to me. Like, because again, I think we're well, like right away you're one, like in terms of per target, especially like, you know, the a target can be an indicator of quality. It might not necessarily be something that should be a denominator in the equation there for a player, because again, you're inherently welcoming in other variables in terms of, what's the quality of targets that they're getting? What's the quality of quarterback play? You know, where are they getting targeted? I think those things can tell you something, but I think more often they, or more often than not, they tell you nothing. So those kind of, those metrics are ones that I don't put a lot of weight in.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So we've talked about this before, and I think that we need to kind of vent about it.
Yes.
But one of the metrics or statistics, I guess, is that we both cannot stand is drops. There's a lot of reasons for it. I want you to take the floor and explain to folks why drops are overrated and why they don't matter nearly as much as why people think that they matter.
Yeah, so if you head to the Google machine and just type in negativity bias and wide receiver drop issues, and you know, maybe throw my name in there, you'll see the piece I wrote about this last offseason that I think is probably going to better explain, and in less ranty fashion, maybe not, the full scale of my thoughts on drops and why I don't take them into effect nearly at all. And here's the thing, you know, I talk about negativity bias. I've talked about several times in the podcast, you know, our brain's inability to properly weight things. And a lot of times, you know, a lot of psychological studies have shown that human beings are just more likely to assign heavier weight to negative events than they are positive events. I mean, I think you can see that play out in your personal life a lot. Yeah. And when you're watching football, it's the same sort of thing, especially if it's a player that you're some, you know, quote unquote, invested in for whatever reason, you know, whether they're on your team or they're on your fantasy team or you know, had bets on them or whatever, like, and they drop a pass, you're going to feel that negative event much more than over the course of the game where they're running 30 to 40 routes and potentially creating great separation or making plays. Like, again, you're just going to, that you're going to feel that negative event of the drop much more, especially because it's just, again, commonplace narrative is like, the receiver's job is to catch the football. If they can't catch, and that's the worst, is when somebody's like, well, yes, he can't catch. Give me a break, dude. If they catch like 80 right, something passes and they happen to drop 10. I mean, again, just weight the positive over the negative. And I think the scale really skews towards far more positive events. Now, again, you're always going to get people that bring up the outliers, what's his name? The guy that played for the Bengals a while ago. I can't remember. Oh, he played for the Browns too. UNC receiver. Oh, Greg Little.
Of course. Greg Little.
Right. You're going to get guys like that thrown at you. Like, okay, well, Greg Little could, yeah, but Greg Little couldn't do anything else that made made living with the drops worth it. Whereas a player like Brandon Marshall drops a ton of passes every year, yep. But people don't talk about that as much because he's also, you know, catching 1,000 yards every season or whatever. He offers, like, that's really the big thing. It's about contextualizing the drops. Where are they getting drops? Do they do things that offer an alternative to living through those drops? I mean, Ted Ginn gets slammed for drops all the time, but Ted Ginn has been a great asset to Carolina the last few years.
Yes.
So the problem with drops is just that we don't know how to properly weigh them. And I mean, I even find myself doing that this morning. I was charting some Josh Reynolds games for reception perception. He had just this awful, hideous drop. And I found myself like shaking my head at it. And again, that's that negativity bias when he's running great routes, creating separation, making some very difficult catches too. So to me, drops become something that gets far more weight. And also, you know, there's a lot of other people have done great work showing that there's really no, you know, year to year relationship to drops. They're incredibly random, and these small, tiny events over hundreds and hundreds of routes that players run over the season.
Yeah. I mean, look, the bottom line is you have to get open in the first place in order to drop a ball, right? So the right. reason the ball is coming that person's way is because they got open. And I think Ted Ginn is the perfect example for drops because Like you said, he was whether people want to believe it or not, he was an unbelievably important piece of the Panthers' offense over the last few years. And you know, the fact that where he's dropping the ball, they're tough to catch in the first place because he's usually going deep, right? But on top of that, when there is a deep ball, it plays into the bias that you're talking about, where people are going to be paying attention to that. Whereas if it's a random slant or out route that goes, you know, 10 yards down the field and a guy like Kelvin Benjamin drops it, it doesn't matter as much, or people don't think about that as much. And then the other thing that I want to mention with drops is to give some pure numbers to it as well. I think that, and you mentioned this too, Matt, but the difference between the guy who drops the most passes in the NFL in 1 year to a guy that drops zero passes is not that significant at all from a strictly a number standpoint. So like, if you look at all the 50 plus target wide receivers last year, there's 92 of them. A handful of them had zero drops. You know, a lot of them had like one or two, but the worst drop rate was Allen Hurns, who had a 7.89% drop rate. But think about what that means. Hurns had six total drops throughout the season, and if you take that across 16 games, that's an incredibly minimal impact on the game, especially when, like you said, you weigh what Allen Hurns does well, right? Where you mm-hmm. look at what he can do and get separation, be a good red zone target, all of the above. If you weigh the drops that heavily, it just doesn't make that much sense.
Right. I mean, I think that you see players with high drop numbers because they also have high target numbers. I mean, there mm-hmm. is a correlation to that. I've seen that play out. And again,
Mike Evans.
Right. Oh, yeah. Of course. I can't even remember how many people would say, yeah, Mike Evans would be great if he could catch. Like, he's had one season at this point in his career where he had a ton of drops. And the other two seasons, it's not been a big issue because he's also been offering a lot more than just beyond what he does with the drops.
Yeah, and, just a little bit more. Mike Evans is pretty good, I guess.
Relatively speaking. But yeah, no, I think that's what people see. When they're watching a game, that's what people see. They see the drop, and especially in, like you mentioned, high degree of important situations, you know, like a third down drop or a drop touchdown pass that would have had them take the lead. They see that, they internalize that, but what they don't see, and, you know, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but what I do go in and see is I see the player running routes, consistently getting separation, and that's what they're asked to do on a play-to-play basis, and you have to assign that more weight than, again, just 10 drops or something throughout the year.
I will say this. The only time that I might say drops matter has nothing to do with how they actually matter to a football game, but more so with coaching decisions. Because I think coaches are sometimes dumb, and I think coaches might weigh some aspects a little bit too heavily compared to other aspects. But even then, it's not to such a great degree that they're saying, oh, Ted Ginn keeps dropping these deep balls, let's just throw him out of the game. Like, it's not right. It's not happening to that degree, you know?
Coaches are also emotional. They're making emotional exactly. decisions. Yes. They're making decisions based off, they need to win games. They need to, you know, minimize risk or whatever, because that's their job. But you also don't see that on like any sort of a situation where it's any sort of normalized formula to how to do it. Like, some players drop passes and they get yanked from games. Fumbles with the running backs is sort of thing. Yes. Like a guy like Adrian Peterson gets, you know, he fumbles all the time, but you don't see him get yanked. And then, you know, poor David Wilson gets yanked yeah. after two or three. And so there's no like uniformity to any of it. It's all just the events themselves are incredibly random. And the way people choose to respond or not respond to them is also incredibly random.
Yes. So Matt, let's talk really quick about this year's draft class. It's an interesting draft class. There's a lot of like meh in it. But who to you stands out as the best receiver in the class? You like Mike Williams, like Corey Davis, who is it?
Yeah, I think this class as a whole, you know, it's been hyped up for so long by people in the dynasty fantasy football community as this, you know, great class that we were all waiting for. But to me, I just don't see a lot of difference makers for fantasy, but I see a lot of really, you know, quality potential NFL receivers, especially in terms of like number twos and number threes. But, you know, for the most part, those players aren't necessarily making differences for fantasy teams. But I do think there's a lot of quality receivers here for teams to draft as complimentary. To me, I think the best guy is Corey Davis out of Western Michigan. You know, you look at his success rate versus man coverage, it's a top three mark that I've charted over the last last two years, of college players. Gets separation at all levels of the field, deep, short, intermediate. He's not like the greatest contested catch receiver. There are several guys in this class that are better than him. But to me, he's just so – I think he's got a great floor, but also has access to a ceiling where he could be an alpha dog in an NFL passing game and be 150 type of target player a year. So to me, I think he's the best player. But the problem with him is we've yet to get athletic testing data on him. And I think that's going to matter a lot, especially for NFL teams that are inherently very risk averse. And he comes from a lower level of competition, which, if I can just touch on that real quick.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
That is a criticism that I get a lot about reception perception. And for one, I don't think there's like a real, you know, strong leaning one way or the other. I think, you know, some bad players at lower level of competition are going to score poorly, and some really good players, you know, like Carlos Henderson is another one that he plays at Louisiana Tech, has ridiculous reception perception scores. But I think that ridiculousness is a good thing to see, and that he's absolutely smashing the assignment, because you can't really hold – I don't think you can hold what a player is being asked to do or who they're being asked to do it against as something that you can weigh against them. Really, it's just, did you execute your assignment? And these players certainly do. There's no real way for me to properly or, you know, objectively weight level of competition unless I was going to go in and chart – back chart like all the cornerbacks in the NFL and in college, and I think it could kind of goes without saying why I'm not going to do that. So yeah, that's just one thing. I get that as a criticism a lot, and it's something that I realize that I'm open to. So it's kind of up to the reader and myself to like mentally adjust for those however you see fit.
Yeah, makes a ton of sense. So you mentioned Corey Davis. I want your thoughts on what you think his biggest weakness would be as he moves to the NFL, but also Mike Williams and John Ross, two other guys. I mean, let's just make the assumption that those will be the top three, just given Ross's combine. What do you think are the biggest weaknesses? I don't care about the strengths. I want to know weaknesses of those three players.
Well, I'll tell you, they're not my top three. But
that's good. Let's do this then. Who are your top three? I obviously only said it just because that's the consensus, of course.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you. I'll give you my top five. My top five are Corey Davis, John Ross, Chris Godwin, then Mike Williams, then Carlos Henderson are like my favorite five guys in this class in terms of just who's good at football.
What was it that – because with Mike Williams, the biggest red flag for me just from strictly a production standpoint was his touchdown market share at Clemson. I know it's really interesting because obviously one of his strengths and what people talk up all the time is his ability to go up and get the ball. But and that generally you would think would translate to the red zone. And I think that it can translate to the red zone, but his touchdown market share didn't really reflect that. And I'm curious, though, as to what you saw out of Mike Williams that he's not, to you, a clear top two guy in this class.
Well, with Mike Williams in particular, I think especially when you're looking at any sort of his production metrics, he's had an interesting career in terms of, you know, he missed an entire season pretty much due to a neck injury. I think that was certainly something like it took him a little bit to get up to speed this year. You can even just observing him play, you can see a little bit of a difference. And frankly, even a difference in his reception perception scores from earlier in the season to the middle of the season to then in the end when he really turned it on. How much does that matter? I don't know. But in terms of Mike Williams, and really it's just about comparing him to Chris Godwin, because when you look at Godwin and you look at Williams, I think you really have to have an honest conversation with yourself of what does Mike Williams do better than Chris Godwin? Because the first thing that you can say is Williams is bigger, but okay. Williams, as you mentioned, his trump card trait is that he wins in the contested catch game. Mm-hmm. Chris Godwin has the highest contested catch conversion rate that I've charted over the last two draft classes, 85.7%. Which is just 0.7% higher than Josh Doxson last year. But Mike Williams has a really strong score at 81.8%. That's great. But again, if Godwin is, you know, his equal or even slightly better in the contested catch game, that doesn't really matter. And Godwin's separation scores for me are way better than Williams. Mm-hmm. I think Williams is good enough in the separation game. You know, a 69% success rate versus man coverage, that is above the 60th percentile over the guys I've had for the last 2 years. But Godwin at 73.8% success rate versus man coverage is a top five score this year. Mm-hmm. It is a score well above the 80th percentile. So, you know, I think you really have to have an honest conversation with yourself, especially when Godwin is younger, more athletic per his testing. What's the difference? And that's why I have Godwin ahead of him. But Williams, I think his biggest question is just, you know, does he separate? I think he does separate well enough, but it's not a dominant enough trait for me to then think he can be a clear alpha in a passing game, where as I think the other players ahead of him have that ability. But I think Williams is certainly a good player that I think is going to be a strong asset to the NFL. But I think there are certainly questions there, like you mentioned.
Yeah. So what did you find about John Ross? He's kind of a divisive topic in wide receiver, just given obviously folks being higher on him since the combine, but other folks saying, oh, he's only done this for a year. But what's your take on John Ross? He was your number two, right?
Yeah, and the reason I would have Ross at two is just and same thing sort of for Henderson that we can hit on a little bit later is like I do really put a premium on these guys that I think have a clear role as a floor, and I think Ross. I mean, listen, he broke the 40. Like I don't think we can understate right. that he is the fastest player ever to be at the combine.
Right.
That matters. It matters a whole hell of a lot to me. Like he's gonna be a lid lifter. One way or another, you cannot like he will impact a team. And you see it when charting him in college, like he gets a ton of space off the line of scrimmage by players that are going to, you know, just be terrified of him burning them over the top. And, you know, that might not necessarily happen to quite the aggressive degree at the NFL level. But what's so great about that is not only does he get that space, but he also earns that space because you see him running routes. You see him very adept at selling that vertical pattern, because that's the thing that a lot of deep threats really need to master is they can't just have the speed. They also have to convince the cornerback that's covering them, you know, by not tipping off the route with their head or their right. eyes or the turn of their direction that they're going to take that route deep before they break back on the sideline routes or the comeback routes to the middle of the field. And that's why when you look at Ross's route tree, he has great success on the out, the dig, the comeback, the curl. And because he's able to take advantage of that intermediate space with his really strong ability as a route runner, that's why I like him to, you know, fall more along in terms of deep threat archetypes. You know, not necessarily that he's at least going to be a Ted Ginn type of player, but I think he has access to being more along the T.Y. Hilton positive end of that archetype because mm-hmm. of his ability to win in other levels of the field.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So before we I let you go, because you're spitting hot fire right now, I kind of don't want you to ever go, but is there a receiver out there that no one's really talking about or not talking enough about that you think could be a really nice maybe late round rookie pick or in dynasty leagues, or is just maybe a later round NFL draft pick that could really have a true impact on an NFL team?
Yeah, I think you know, there's this class is I can't say, you know, guys like Godwin, Henderson, Taywan Taylor, those are all players that really, even Josh Reynolds is a player. Like I said, I just finished his sample. I like him a lot. I think all those guys will be impacts, but you already hear buzz about them. I'll give you two players that I think are under the radar in terms of both dynasty drafts and the NFL. One is Isaiah Ford out of Virginia Tech. He's got a great production profile, not a great athletic tester, but he has an 80% success rate versus man coverage, which trails only Sterling Shepard over prospects that I have the last 2 years. And we saw Shepard translate to the NFL pretty seamlessly. I think Ford, like, he has just an average contested catch conversion rate. He's not great after the catch in terms of my metrics, but he was pressed more than any other player I have over the last 2 years, 94 attempts against press, which we know isn't that prevalent at the college level. And he had a success rate that was above the 88th. He was a 88th percentile success rate versus press coverage. And listen, I just think there's always going to be a place for players that separate like that. He's a very kind of Stephon Diggs type of player. Maybe doesn't have that sort of ceiling that we saw Diggs show this year. But I think, again, there's just always going to be a place for guys that separate and run really good routes. And Ford is already quite advanced at that. And you see him consistently go in the third round of dynasty rookie mocks I've been a part of. So if he goes to a good spot, that's one guy to look out. And then a player that I just wrote about yesterday, and you can find all this analysis at receptionperception.com this year, by the way.
Perfect.
Ryan Switzer. I just published him yesterday.
Interesting.
And listen, I think it's just, I called the piece the Ryan Switzer and the annual archetypal discount. And that's that little slot receiver archetype is just always discounted. But the good thing about Switzer is I think he falls again in terms of that slot receiver archetype falls more along the level of players like Jameson Crowder or mm-hmm. Doug Baldwin, guys that they run routes from the slot, but they win in that intermediate area of the field. They don't just get slants and all of that. You see you see Ryan Switzer get solid separation on those intermediate patterns, but also just a really reliable player. So listen, he's going to be a player that goes on the third day of the NFL draft. If he goes to the right spot, you know, if he goes to a spot like Carolina, which I think, you know, they could use a player like that, yeah, somebody totally. Create instant separation. But, you know, he might catch like 60, 70 passes a year. But if he goes to the right spot like a Jamison Crowder did to Washington, that's a high volume passing offense, he's going to be a player that can threaten 90 to 100 catches at some point. Because, again, those guys are just always discounted. So that's a pretty easy answer.
I love it. I love it. So you can find everything, as you said, all of your reception perception stuff at receptionperception.com. Correct?
Yes, sir.
And you can find Matt Harmon on what's your Twitter handle again, Matt?
Oh my God. It's at Matt Harmon _BYB. And listen, I was telling this to my friend Jordan Rodriguez, the Charlotte Observer, who's on my podcast recently, that essentially the underscore, and I know that's not the part you really want to make me fun of me for, but
this is a different podcast, so I won't make fun of you for it.
That's terrific. But yeah, the underscore, I know it's basically like I got an ex-girlfriend tattooed on my, like her name tattooed on my body. Like that's what the underscore is. Like, listen, I was young, I was foolish, I made a mistake, but there's nothing I can do about it. It's a part of the brand now and it's tattooed on my career resume. So here we are.
Totally get it, man. Thank you so much for coming on, Matt. And thank you all for listening to episode 2 of the Late Round Podcast. Again, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, any of them. Go to iTunes, search the Number Fire Podcast Network, hit subscribe, and never miss a show again. Thanks, guys.